Blog Talk Radio. Body of water, a scull boat, a competitive rower. In a three-seat scull boat, but only one rower and two mystery guests. Hello, everyone. I'm Lauren Leibowitz, and welcome to Blog Talk Radio and How to Be Comfortable in Your Own Shoes. It is Thursday, July 15th, and once again, we are coming to you live from Los Angeles, as I do every Thursday at 3 p.m. Pacific Time, and thank you so much for joining us today, and we'd love to hear from you, so please call in to listen live or ask questions at 347-857-2710. Those 10 digits are 347-857-2710. We are live until 3:45 p.m. Pacific Time. You are in for a very special treat today, as my guest has a unique story of her own to share with us. While at the pinnacle of physical ability in pursuit of the U.S. national rowing team, my guest Monica Downer was struck by overwhelming weakness and fatigue that ended her five-year competitive career. Her story to restore her health is an eye-opening tale of mystery, magic, and overcoming the odds. So please give a warm welcome to Monica Downer. Hi, Monica.
Hi, Lauren.
This is always the part that gets people, like, okay, then where do we go from here? Your turn.
Thanks for having me. I really appreciate you, you know, bringing this story to light, and hopefully, you know, some people will benefit from it.
I think people have already have. I want to share with our listeners who may have also heard your wonderful interview on NPR with Dick Gordon and the story talking about your own personal story. I know we spoke just moments before going on the air, and I mentioned to you that I have gotten some feedback from some of my friends who have listened to your story on NPR, and it was a very interesting story. And let's first of all describe, as I mentioned in the opening, that you are a rower. And
yes,
the boat is the scull of the boat, and you in a three seated skull, you are the only physical body in there, but you found out that there was a mysterious competitor with you.
Right, which I didn't know at the time. You know, I was pursuing the U.S. national team for a number of years as a full-time athlete, getting up to the level of about 800 year hours of training, which is considered an elite level. And just, you know, living on the East Coast a lot of the time during the year, the racing was better there, a lot more competitions, a lot more of the rowing athletes are out there. And, of course, the national team is out there. So I spent a lot of time on the East Coast. But I'm from Los Angeles, so,
woohoo,
you know,
one for our side. Woo. Yeah.
Yeah. So I just, you know, was pursuing this team, and I had – just to kind of step back a bit, I in college had been a rower, but when I graduated, I felt like at the time that was a little far of a reach for me, and I really didn't want to pursue being an athlete for years and years and then wake up one day and just realize, like, hey, I don't have a career, and my, you know, my body's broken down, and now I'm going to have to start over in my 30s or something. So I went on after college and pursued a career.
Well,
didn't
you
go back.
Have been a commentary then, right? You could have been a commentator.
Right. I know, that would have been perfect.
Exactly.
But I you know, I didn't go back into rowing until I had actually a couple different careers and then had been laid off, and I felt comfortable enough that, you know, hey, you know, I'll just go ahead and pursue the U.S. national team.
Well,
you know, I just wanted to check
that
one off my list, I guess. I don't know.
Well, what made you decide that? I know you went to graduate school in journalism, and
yes.
So you pursued a career in journalism, and it sounds...
I did, and I had been an editorial director for a company called Gaiam, and it, you know, a lot of writing, a lot of editing, a lot of sitting. And I had been an athlete, you know, in college and even growing up, and I just felt like, hey, I'd like to be an athlete again. I know I just wanted to be physical again, and I enjoy competition. And what's so great about sculling is it's this technical sport that's also kind of meditative, especially in a single scull, where you're going backwards, which is a bit of trust, you know, like to get a sense of, oh, okay, I'm going backwards. You're doing it on your own, and you're dealing with wind and water and wakes and everything else, you know, sometimes dolphins, sometimes birds. I mean, there's all kinds of things you can encounter. So you're always dealing with the elements, yet you're doing this, you know, technical precision sport that takes a lot of sort of mind over body type of thinking to do well. So it was a fun challenge, you know, sort of mentally and physically for me, and I really enjoyed it, and it was fun to then be, you know, with much younger people training and competing on a really high level.
Now, did you feel your age was a detriment to you because you were...
No, it wasn't, because, you know, women actually... sort of as an endurance athlete, as we know from Dara Torres at the Olympics in swimming, you know, older women, their endurance levels are just much greater. And so rowing is really, it's a power and it's an endurance sport. So that didn't hinder me at all. I was always in the top group. And that particular year in 2005, I had finished a personal best time. We had to do testing during the year, and then I had a personal best. And then in April...
So what was your personal best? I'm dying to know.
Oh, well, it was a 6K time, which is a 6,000-meter ergometer test. And for me, I think it was 23:15 at the time, 23 minutes, 15 seconds. And, you know, it's a very painful type of sport. An event, because you're really pushing, trying to push beyond your limits in some ways, especially your mental limits. You know, you're really having to push beyond that, and like your mind is going, oh, stop, this hurts, ouch, you know, and your body's going, no, sorry, we're going to continue.
No, but I think that's an attitude one needs to have, you know, as an athlete, and I know you're a swimmer also. In any kind of sport, you have to push yourself beyond a certain limit to get to that next level.
Yeah. And in life, I mean, for me, rowing's always been a metaphor for life too. I mean, it's been great in that, you know, you can practice these things that make you uncomfortable, and you can kind of go beyond it, and you can surprise yourself in the end and go, hey, that wasn't so bad after all. You know, it was really just me thinking it was going to be a bad experience or whatever. So,
right, and it's beautiful. I've seen rowing on a lake, then, and it's, there's a rhythm, and it's very
mm-hmm.
graceful. And so, like you said, when all the when everything is aligned, it's very easy and effortless. It looks that way, like you're skating on the top of the water. You're floating.
Yes. Yeah, it's beautiful to watch, and especially when you get into, you know, doubles and quads, which are sculling boats. And sculling, the difference between a sculling boat and a sweep boat is, in the sculling boat, you have each rower has two oars, and it's much more symmetrical. You're sitting up more straight, and you know you're using both sides of your body. Sweep rowing, on the other hand, are the eights and the four and the pair, and that is each rower has one oar, and it's a big oar, 12-foot oar, and you know it's a long handle. Both of your hands are on this one handle, and then you're pivoting around a rigger, and so it's a little more, it's less symmetrical. But that's, you know, that's a power sport, and those are where, you know, we've won Olympic golds in numerous Olympics in the eight.
Yes.
So, but it's almost it's somewhat of a different sport than sculling. Sculling is a much more technical sport.
So here you are, an athlete about to try your hand at the national team, and
yes. So
what happens?
Well, so I can tell you just about this particular year, you know, I'm feeling like it's this is going to be my year. I had previously, that the summer of 2004, you know, every event is sort of designed to get you to the next step, and you have to cross all these, you know, sort of borders before you make the team. That was 2004 to make the Olympics in the double for the lightweight team. For the double is what I was going for, and I didn't make that. So the next boat to try for is the quad, and the quad is not an Olympic boat. It's a world champion boat. So I went for the quad, and we didn't make that. So I went to U.S. Nationals, and I ended up winning in the double. So I ended up, you know, being a U.S. national champion, which is fantastic, in 2004. So that was that summer, and then the next spring is when I'm back in New Jersey, getting ready for the next selection regatta in the single for either a world or national team boat, which is an off year of the Olympics. So those are your only options during an off Olympic year.
Is to try to train for that next coming Olympic.
You're trying to make the world team. Basically, that was the next big international event was World Championships. So for me, it would be either in the single, the double, or the quad. Those are the three boats I would go for. So the first race that you race is the single. So I go and I race the single in April. It's the end of April, and it's in New Jersey. It's Princeton, New Jersey. And I did really well. And I'm thinking, this is going to be my year. I felt really, really good. I finished in the top 10, but you know, separated by, you know, tenths and hundredths of a second. So what ends up happening is the people that, you know, they race and then they're in the top group in the single, and then they try to double up and they try to find a partner for the double. So I was invited to go to Boston to a camp there with the other single scullers who are in that top group. And I get to Boston, and 4 days into the training there, I just suddenly had this burning sensation in my back. And I thought, wow, that's kind of weird. And so I'm feeling kind of fatigued. I'm thinking, well, maybe it's because, you know, I'm sort of out of my element. I'm having to ride my bike. I'm doing all these things that's a little bit out of my element. And then it's really cold. Then we're doing seat racing, which is when you have boats next to each other, you race them, and then you switch rowers, and then you see which boat consistently goes fastest. So we were seat racing, and I was always within. It was very competitive, so I was always within that top group. And one day we're seat racing, and I push my legs down, and there's nothing there. I mean, I don't know if you've ever – I don't think anyone's ever had this kind of feeling before. Where
you lost feeling in your legs? What do you mean by nothing?
It's almost like someone pulled the plug on my energy and my muscular ability. Like someone just went, oh, okay, oops, you know, plug out, unplug the plug. And I pushed, and there was like nothing there. I mean, there, you know, your brain's going, okay, push hard, and your body's going, sorry, I can't, no can do.
And what was it, kind of an out-of-body experience? Did you hear the other
rowers? I'm like continuing to move, and there was just one. There was one stroke that had nothing. And then it came back, and I was like, wow, like what the heck was that? And then and I started to get worried. And I thought, oh, maybe I'm out of iron. Maybe I'm not eating enough, you know, because I was a lightweight, so I'm kind of cutting calories at that point. Mm-hmm. And so there's all these sort of elements that are mixing in. But then we pack up our boat. We end up getting our particular assignments with the rower that we're going to row with. And, you know, I'm with her, and we get our boat, and we drive from Boston to Princeton. And I'm just not feeling that great. Like, when we get there, I'm just not feeling so hot, and I'm just really getting worried, like something's going on. And then
do they have a team doctor that you can go to say these are your experiences? Or
they don't. I mean, they have a – there was a doctor in Princeton in the city, but – I just didn't think I was sick. I just thought I was weak, you know. So it's like I'm not really associating. I'm not thinking that clearly, I guess. I don't know. They don't. The team has a doctor, but I'm not part of the team. Like, I'm trying to make the team, so none of that's available to me.
Interesting. So here you are kind of on your own little journey to figure out.
Exactly.
Something.
I'm trying to figure this out on my own. So we get there, and we, you know, do a sweat run, which is where we try to lose weight. and I have to stop, and I tell her, you know, I need to walk back. And I'm thinking, I might need to be picked up. I don't know that I can even walk. And I had this feeling that someone was, it felt like someone was pouring molten lava in the top of my head and it going down my body. It was just on fire. So that was weird.
That is weird and quite disconcerting, I would think.
Very disconcerting. And I'm calling home and I'm like, oh my gosh, what should I do? Meantime, at the same time, like there is this athlete in Philadelphia, a young 18-year-old who actually passed away after racing, actually during the, you know, at the end of the race. And I'm thinking, oh gosh, you know, maybe it's just training. Maybe I've trained too much, or, you know, all these just thoughts are just going through my head because obviously something's wrong, but I had no idea what it was.
So what level did you go to finally realize, you know, it's not my training and it has nothing to do with rowing? There's definitely something perhaps.
You know, it took a while. I mean, when I had to, I tried to race, and this is the end of my rowing saga, is that I tried to race for 500 meters, and then my body, that feeling that I had for one stroke, it was for every stroke. So then I, you know, it's like I had to stop. And then I just flew home. I flew home to Los Angeles, which was, you know, a different area, you know, a different part of the country. Now, had I stayed in Princeton, or had I gone to a doctor there, or had I gone to the hospital or something, maybe I would have figured this out sooner. But I came back here, and in 3 days I went and saw a doctor here that took a blood test, and he called me, and he's like, oh, you know, blood test looks normal.
Yeah, it's amazing.
Go ahead and go row. And that was my first, like, a doctor can really say, like, I've just told you I could hardly function, and that's, you know, that's all he can tell me? And that was my first kind of indication that, maybe all doctors aren't equal, you know. But at that point, I just kind of let it go, and I was like, okay, I called the physiologist for the U.S. national team. And then I went to the Olympic Training Center in Chula Vista, and I saw the physiologist there, and you know, talked to him and told him what happened, and he evaluated my training plan. He's looking at what I was doing as an athlete, and he's like, well, it sounds to me like you might have central fatigue, which is central nervous system fatigue, you know, maybe overtraining. So I'm thinking I was overtrained. So I thought, okay, I'll just rest. So that's kind of how it started. You know, it took a while for me. It wasn't until a year, and I'm not really getting better. I still, you know, I can't really exercise at all without being really, really fatigued. And then I felt shaky, dizzy. You know, there's all these other things that happen at the same time.
Yeah. Well, let's tell our listeners that you're talking about Lyme disease. This is what you eventually figured out that you had. Along with, and we'll address that too, a mold situation. There were two mysterious friends that were visiting. Mm-hmm. One was Lyme disease, and how did you finally determine that that was the cause or part of the cause?
That was interesting. I was, and this is where, you know, I think it's important for people to know who have ever thought, well, maybe, you know, maybe I did have a tick bite, or maybe I didn't have a tick bite, but they have this mysterious illness. There are ticks in California, and there are a lot of people with Lyme disease that are not diagnosed. And part of the problem is because there is a test called an ELISA screening test. And a standard doctor that you go to, even a specialist, who I saw a neurologist at the time because I had burning, so I was like, well, that sounds like a neurologist. You know, he gave me that screening test, and that screening test was negative. Well, the reason it was negative is because that screening test was designed to screen out someone who has been bitten within 30 days, and I had been bitten over a year previously. So what ends up happening is your body has this bacteria in it that suppresses your immune system because your immune system cannot fight it. It's too much. And it suppresses your immune system, so your immune system doesn't send, you know, the antibodies don't come out to then fight off this bacteria. So the blood test that's designed to detect antibodies, and there's no antibodies there. So it looks like your test is negative. So there you go. So then I'm thinking I don't have that. So I'm still plodding along, doctor after doctor after doctor, going to doctor.
You went Eastern, Western. You tried everything.
Everything. And any if someone suggested something, I would go. And, you know, they might have helped me in some small way, but what was interesting is that none of them could give me an explanation of the whole thing, the whole picture. Like, why was it this whole thing? They could only say, like, oh, well, maybe this part explains this, but it doesn't explain that. So that's why I kept looking for an answer from people, and I just wasn't getting it. Eventually, and I mean, that's, you know, kind of an interesting saga. It was like 22 doctors.
22 doctors. That's a disappointment. You go to someone who has spent, what, 15 years in college or higher education to kind of figure out more than a common cold, and they can't offer you anything. And it's not so much maybe that they don't give you the right diagnosis, is that they're not there with you to see, okay, we're going to figure this out. It's like, I'm sorry,
that's
not my problem.
Yeah, right. And what I found interesting, too, is that some, you know, there was a spine specialist, for example. I mean, he was ready to take a disc out of my neck. He was ready to have neck surgery.
What was his
diagnosis? And it's like, you know, once you're in a specialty, you sort of have these blinders on, and that's everything you see within your limited vision of your specialty. You can't see out of it. That was what was so surprising to me. So, yeah, no one followed along. No one said, come back in, we'll figure this out. There were people that had compassion, but there was one doctor in particular I met with for an hour. I told him my whole situation. He scratched his head, and he's like, I don't know. I don't even know what to tell you. And I actually called him back after I left, and I said, you know, I really want my money back. I think he was doctor like 17 or something. And I said, you know, you didn't provide me any answers. You didn't provide me any recommendations for somebody else, someplace else to go. And I said, I really just want my money back.
He did
give it back to me. And there was another doctor who I spent an hour with, and she recommended, you know, somebody to me. And I said, you know, I just don't think that's I don't think that's correct. I mean, I got to that point, I'm like telling doctors, no, I just think you're wrong. And then I asked her for my money back, and she cut her rate. She didn't give me all my money back, but she did cut her rate.
Well, it's also about listening to your body, and because you had such a challenging time trying to have these medical professionals listen to what you're trying to tell them about how your body is responding, and they're not getting it, that our bodies are the key to, okay, what's wrong, what's going on, what is that inner voice telling us, and that's what you have to trust to move forward, and obviously you did. And who was the final person you went to?
Well, eventually, you know, there was sort of a low point, I like to say, and it was so frustrating to not have answers from, you know, all these doctors and stuff and not feel like I'm making any improvements. And my boyfriend said to me, you know, you're just going to have to sort of accept who you are at this moment. And I sort of interpreted that like saying to accept being sick, and that's not what he was saying. What he explained to me later is like surrender to this idea. Surrender that this is what you're dealing with right now, and this is like, maybe I'm not explaining it that well, but it's like it sort of changes you from fighting to find an answer, and you sort of let go. You sort of let go and just allow stuff to come to you, and at this point is when I found the guy who ended up helping me.
That's a very hard thing to do, is surrender.
It's a very hard thing to do, absolutely.
But you wanted to heal, and so you kind of have to weigh.
I just started to be, and my whole, like, how I dealt with the world really changed in this whole process of being like, you know, push, 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 you know, go-getter, to hands off and allowing life to just happen. I have a coach from Poland, and he would try to tell me about that. He'd say, you know, you look like you're rowing. He says, you look like you're pushing the water. He's like, you're trying to move the ocean. He goes, don't try to move the ocean. Allow allow the ocean to support you and feel the ocean under you.
Oh, you're strong.
Feel
if
the
you
water.
Push the ocean, girl.
Yeah, you know, you're like, you're just like really manhandling. You know, you're just trying to like get through life, you know, that way. And that's kind of how I was. And so when I really changed my thinking, that's when things started to happen. So
and
through a friend.
Yes, I'm sorry.
Sorry. Through a friend is who recommended this doctor totally randomly. I never would have found this person on my own. And they just found that I had this complex illness, and they started sort of peeling the onion, the layer of, you know, this onion of my health, and peeling each layer off and trying to rebuild my immune system. And then while I was in getting these IV vitamin C drips, which help with the viral load, I had such a huge viral load, because when you have something like Lyme, what it does is it suppresses your immune system so much that the viruses that you've had throughout your entire life, they all come back. They all start to reactivate because your immune system can't do anything. So then you have, it's like you're constantly sick. So you have the viruses, and then what happens is your blood develops a fiber to coat your blood vessels from the inside, so nothing gets out because your body's going, whoa, there's like way too much stuff in here. It's like a toxic sludge. So it coats your blood vessels, so oxygen and nutrients don't go out of your blood into your tissues, and so this is why you're weak all the time and you're fatigued. So I'm getting treatment for that. And I'm sitting there, you know, next to someone else who has an IV drip, and, you know, there's signs on the walls, don't talk about your health to other people, or don't, you know, there's like privacy laws and stuff. And, of course, I was like, I'm just too curious. I said, so what are you in for? You know, like, we're tethered to these IV, you know, IV drips. And he says, you know, as a matter of fact, and he told me the story, he's from New Jersey. And then he said, yeah, all these years he had this mysterious illness and he couldn't figure it out. And finally, he was just about to go back to New Jersey where he's from, and they figured out he had Lyme disease. And I was like, that's interesting, because, you know, when I got sick, I was in New Jersey. This all happened in New Jersey.
This is not a good sign for New Jersey. You know?
Not a good sign for New Jersey. I know, right?
Yeah.
So then I asked to be, because when I first went to them, they wanted to test me for Lyme disease. And I go, no, you know, I've already been tested for Lyme, so I don't want to pay for another blood test. But I went back to them and I said, you know, could you retest me for Lyme? Because I just want to see. And so I was retested and it came back negative. So I just was like, oh, well, maybe that wasn't it then. And at the time, I got a job to work on the Olympics. So I was going to the Olympics in 2008, and they improved my health to be able to actually go on that trip, which was amazing. I mean, I had been sick for a while, so to be able to handle the travel, the stress, overnight shift, and being around other people who had colds was
huge. This is
huge.
Working in the Olympics. This is not
being in the Olympics. Yes, no. I'm sorry. Yes, I was a researcher for NBC on the Olympics. And it was an amazing experience. And when I came, it wasn't until I came back and I had my hair falling out, which is probably due to stress, went back to my doctor and he said, oh, you know, this Lyme test isn't negative. And I said, what do you mean? And that's when I learned about this whole idea that this Lyme test can be negative. So what they do now is they look at bands, and there are certain bands that are numbered. And if you have these bands that are positive, then generally those are specific Lyme bands, and that's how they can tell, versus that ELISA test, that screening test I told you about that the CDC uses.
Right.
So this is a different test, yeah.
But is that screening test more accurate if someone goes after a 30-day period of if they see a bite or something's not right and they have this?
Yeah, I mean, that's if you really just got bit and then you have the rash. The bullseye rash is the typical thing, and that's what the guidelines are for diagnosis, is if you have this rash, then yes, you have it. The problem is that misses like 85% of the people who either don't see the rash is very faded and you just can't tell. They might be dark skinned. they've got bit on their back. I mean, there's any number of reasons, and so many people don't see this rash or don't have this rash. So that's not a good criteria, in other words. It just misses a ton of people. So what ends up happening is people get what's called chronic Lyme that this governing body does not believe exists, but there's another governing body that does. So you have two, you know, opposing groups, and this is, you know, part of the problem of Lyme is that there isn't a consensus on how to treat Lyme. So you have doctors who are taking it upon themselves to become literate, so you call them Lyme literate MDs. They know about, for example, which is the proper Lyme test to use, and they know how to interpret the results. And then what they do is they treat based on symptoms. Well, they get a Lyme test that's positive, and then they also treat based on symptoms.
Well, it seems to be more prevalent now, Lyme disease, than it has been in years past. So, because I have heard that a lot of the medical community don't even consider it a disease. So
they don't. They think 2 weeks of antibiotics will cure it, which is just completely laughable. Obviously insurance companies don't want you to, you know, have this ongoing treatment. So that's, you know, you've got that to deal with as well.
That's very true. Now, you also had another situation about mold. Now, this was while you're healing from Lyme disease?
Right. Well, the interesting thing about, you know, of course, when you have something like Lyme and you have it for a long time and it's been undiagnosed, like I was telling you before, that your immune system becomes severely suppressed and you pick up, you know, kind of everything. So being in a beach community in a, you know, moist area, it's actually quite common to get mold illness. It's called biotoxin illness. And someone who, again, is a Lyme literate MD would know that, and they tested me for that, and I had high levels of Aspergillus. So that's a toxic mold, and it does certain things to your body. So, you know, that's another thing, that if you have the combination, if you have this Lyme, say, that, you know, goes undiagnosed, and then you live in a moist environment, you could have, you know, a combo platter of these illnesses, and it's really interesting. You know, it's very difficult to find someone who can figure that out and then to, you know, peel away those layers and get, you know, to your immune system and then heal that and restore your health so you can then, you know, function like you should function, like you've functioned before.
So where are you now health-wise? Are you completely...
I am, like... Almost, I say I'm almost normal, health-wise.
can we even say that? I mean, I don't think I'm almost normal, and I think
right.
I'm,
yeah,
I'm
I know. That's huge. To be able to just know, like, you know, what to do when you start to feel a little weird, then that's huge. That's huge.
That is,
I mean, most
when you're
most
back
people
to...
that have this illness, they suffer for years and years and years.
Well, because I think some of the symptoms of Lyme disease are symptoms of other diseases. And so, like you're saying, these doctors
That's
are not always
true.
Lyme literate.
And then you're going, yes, they're not Lyme literate, and that you're going to doctors and they're telling you, oh, you know, you have fibromyalgia. Oh, there's a big one. That's a diagnosis for nothing because they don't know what causes that. So if they don't know what causes that, how can that be a diagnosis for something? It's not. It's just a diagnosis for, like, muscle pain. And I'm not diminishing anyone who has that diagnosis at all because it is such a big deal to have a name for what you're dealing with so that you have some sort of direction. That is the most frustrating thing when you're sick, is to not have some sort of direction and not know what you're dealing with.
Well, I think you want somebody to say, you know what? You have it.
You have X, Y, and Z.
You got it.
Yes, absolutely. It makes you feel very comforted. But at the same time, just keep it in the back of your mind. This might not be correct. That's all I'm saying. Is if someone says, oh, you have fibromyalgia, then just remember, have this little voice in the back of your mind going, that might not be right. Maybe that answers a little bit of what I have, but maybe that's not the answer. And I kept having that attitude throughout all these doctors that gave me a diagnosis of something different. Every one of them gave me something different.
So it's about surrendering. You used what your boyfriend suggested you do, that ability to surrender, let go of maybe controlling the outcome. And
getting invested in these diagnoses. Getting invested in these things. Like I went to the spine guy and he's like, oh, you know, you have a bulging disc and it could be torn and it could be leaking onto your nerves and that's why it's burning and the only thing we can do is take it out. And I'm calling him crying, oh my gosh, I'm going to have to take out my cervical disc. And then he's like, no, just remember, don't believe what people say about you. Because when you internalize that and you think, oh, that's me, I have that, I'm just terrible, No, just throw that away and just keep plugging forward. Just keep knowing that you're going to get better. And you don't necessarily, I mean, having a name is great for an illness and having a direction is really important. But just, surrender and just keep moving forward and don't get too invested in how sick you are, if that's possible to do. Just be active with what you have. If you have an illness, just keep moving forward. In some small way.
You said something very important about that, and it's generally about an attitude. It's about changing your attitude on how you view your situation. An illness is a horrible thing for anyone to go through, especially your situation where you did all the legwork, the research. You still didn't know what was going on, but how do you make it more, turn it into a positive light that so you can find answers? Because it's about finding an answer.
Right. And really pushing the limits of your thinking. I mean, it's really, life is about experiencing things. And, you know, this is your experience right now. It's of being a sick person. And so how...
You experience this situation in life for a particular reason?
I don't know about that. I mean, I just think everything in our lives is an opportunity to learn something. So it's just there for us. And rather than fall back on the way we think, you know, move forward and maybe expand the way you think about yourself or expand the way you do things. I mean, they're really just opportunities for you to become a better person in some way. And open yourself up and maybe meet new people and learn new things. I mean, that's how I see it. I mean, it's just like growing. It's like, okay, here's another workout. Okay, I'm not judging the workout. I'm not going to be freaked out by it. I'm just going to go do it, and I'll be okay with that. Whatever happens, I might be tired, but, you know, I'll be okay with it. It's just there. It's something for me to do.
Exactly, and how do you find the solution? It's not to put blame on anyone or anything that caused something specific. It's that, okay, here we are, I have these symptoms, so how do I move forward? Like you said, how do I take that next step to find out why I'm feeling this way? Okay, now you glean information, and you continue to move forward. It's about coming to a solution to your situation.
And because, you know, blaming others or blaming a situation can be somewhat poisonous. It doesn't really move you forward in any way. It kind of keeps you mired in what you're in. It makes you feel worse because it's something out of your control, and then you're sort of a victim. So I always believe in just taking responsibility for myself 100%. So if that happened to me, you know, okay, you know, it's what am I going to do about it?
A lot of people don't like being in the victim mode because it brings attention to them. It allows other people to say, oh, hey, I'll help you, I'll come save you, and it doesn't allow that person to realize that they have the power within themselves to be in charge of their life, and we're all given choices, and so they made a different choice. It's not a good or a bad choice, it's just a choice that they've made, but through your example and your wonderful story, you see, by doing your choice and living your life, being vulnerable in life and allowing opportunities to come to you, in a sense, this is an example of a particular outcome. And
yeah.
And you're still you're in charge of your life. That's empowering.
Yes. Yes, definitely. You know, some days are good days and some days are you know, maybe not so good days, but it's just always staying positive and having some kind of support system. I mean, I'm very fortunate to have, you know, a partner who's absolutely wonderful. So a lot of, you know, I have someone to, you know, bounce ideas off of and who really always keeps me thinking positively. And if you're someone who might be alone or, you know, have an illness that they're dealing with alone and they don't have the means to then find help, that's very difficult. And it's again, it's another challenge, and how you overcome that is, you know, kind of who you are. So just keep moving forward. I mean, that's all I can say is that there might be someone who is out there who will help you. So just to always keep moving forward and try not to hold yourself back. And, oh, and the thing that really kept me going, too, is that I always listened. Like, I would tell my story to people, and then I would listen for the answer, because a lot of people, they have maybe an inspiration or something that they would share, and I would take that to heart. You know, I didn't just tell my story and then, like, it was like the beginning, middle, and end of my book, and I didn't really need to hear any feedback. I put my story out there with the hopes of someone giving me something in return, like maybe they heard of something or they could, you know, give me the name of a doctor or something. They could guide me in some way. And that did. That was a big way I was able to navigate the medical system, was through telling the story and listening to people, and they guided me. So that's huge.
That's trust. That's trust that there are people who are willing to help you, who are out there, and all you have to do is let them in. And
you just never know. I mean, I met someone at a wedding. Yeah, you know, someone I didn't know, and I just told the story to, and she's like, you know, have you ever tried cranial sacral? And I was like, oh, no. I mean, I've heard of it, but you might, you know. She's like, maybe that'll help. And so it's that kind of thing. It's like it could be someone at a bus stop, you know. It doesn't have to be anything in particular. I mean, it doesn't have to be, you know, a particular friend that you have a relationship with. It could be a stranger.
That's true.
Or someone you just, you know, an acquaintance.
That's exactly true. And you are just being so gracious of sharing your own story. And we're going to give our listeners your email. So if they are experiencing something or know a friend that is going down the same path as you had, you're more than willing to share your resources with them. So if you'd like to contact Monica, you can email her at mdowner, D-O-W-N-E-R, 66, at yahoo.com. So Monica's done all the legwork for you. So, but the journey is the legwork. That's where you kind of get all this wonderful information and.
And the joy is helping others.
Absolutely.
There have been a couple people that I've talked to that had very similar symptoms. One woman we met, and we actually compared blood tests, believe it or not, and. I said, you know, your blood looks very similar to mine, and maybe you should just double check, you know, for Lyme disease. And she ended up having it. She's a housewife in Torrance, and she spent no time in New Jersey or any place like that. So it was a shock to her to find that out.
Yeah, well, I want to thank you so much. Your story is fascinating, and you are a fascinating woman indeed, and I'm looking forward to hearing you back on the Skull Boat competing. I think that would be an even better story. So, Monica, thank you so much for joining me. It was just a pleasure to have you on the show.
Thank you so much for having me.
You're so welcome. And once again, to contact Monica, you can reach her at her email at mdowner66@yahoo.com. And please join me next time for another wild and crazy journey in someone else's shoes, as my mystery guest will be. This is Lauren Leibowitz, and thank you so much for joining me today and listening to How to Be Comfortable in Your Own Shoes and Monica Downer and her story. So we hope to see you next time, and I look forward to helping you find comfort in your own shoes.
So